Audio Renaissance presents Dune Messiah by Frank Herbert. Read for you by Simon Vance, Scott Brick, Catherine Kellgren, and Ewan Morton.
Excerpts from the Death Cell Interview with Bronzo of Ix. Question. What led you to take your particular approach to a history of Muad'Dib? Answer. Why should I answer your questions? Because I will preserve your words. The ultimate appeal to a historian. Will you cooperate then? Why not? But you'll never understand what inspired my analysis of history. Never. You priests have too much at stake to try me. Try you? Well, again, why not? I was caught by the shallowness of the common view of this planet, which arises from its popular name, Dune. Not Arrakis, notice, but Dune. History is obsessed by Dune as desert, as birthplace of the Fremen. Such history concentrates on the customs which grew out of water scarcity, and the fact that Fremen led semi-nomadic lives in stillsuits which recovered most of their body's moisture. Are these things not true, then? They are surface truth. As well ignore what lies beneath that surface as try to understand my birth planet, Ix, without exploring how we derived our name from the fact that we are the ninth planet of our sun. No. No. It is not enough to see Dune as a place of savage storms. It is not enough to talk about the threat posed by the gigantic sandworms. But such things are crucial to the Erekian character. Crucial. Of course. But they produce a one-view planet in the same way that Dune is a one-crop planet, because it is the sole and exclusive source of the spice melange. Yes, let us hear you expand on this sacred spice. Sacred. As with all things sacred, it gives with one hand and takes with the other. It extends life and allows the adept to foresee his future, but it ties him to a cruel addiction and marks his eyes as yours are marked, total blue without any white. Your eyes, your organs of sight, become one thing without contrast, a single view. Such heresy brought you to this cell. I was brought to this cell by your priests. As with all priests, you learned early to call the truth heresy. You are here because you dared to say that Paul Atreides lost something essential to his humanity before he could become Muad'Dib. Not to speak of his losing his father here in the Harkonnen War. Nor the death of Duncan Idaho, who sacrificed himself that Paul and the Lady Jessica could escape. Your cynicism is duly noted. Cynicism? That, no doubt, is a greater crime than heresy. But you see, I'm not really a cynic. I'm just an observer and commentator. I saw true nobility in Paul as he fled into the desert with his pregnant mother. Of course, she was a great asset as well as a burden. The flaw in you historians is that you'll never leave well enough alone. You see true nobility in the holy Muad'Dib, but you must append a cynical footnote. It's no wonder that the Bene Gesserit also denounce you. You priests do well to make common cause with the Bene Gesserit sisterhood. They too survive by concealing what they do. But they cannot conceal the fact that the Lady Jessica was a Bene Gesserit-trained adept. You know she trained her son in the sisterhood's ways. My crime was to discuss this as a phenomenon, to expound upon their mental arts and their genetic program. You don't want attention called to the fact that Muad'Dib was the Sisterhood's hoped-for captive messiah, that he was their Kwisatz Haderach before he was your prophet. If I had any doubts about your death sentence, you have dispelled them. I can only die once. There are deaths, and there are deaths. Beware lest you make a martyr of me. I do not think Muad'Dib... Tell me, does Muad'Dib know what you do in these dungeons? We do not trouble the Holy Family with trivia. And for this, Paul Atreides fought his way to a niche among the Fremen. For this, he learned to control and ride the sandworm. It was a mistake to answer your questions. But I will keep my promise to preserve your words. Will you really? Then listen to me carefully, you Fremen degenerate. You priest with no god except yourself. You have much to answer for. It was a Fremen ritual which gave Paul his first massive dose of melange, thereby opening him to visions of his futures. It was a Fremen ritual by which that same melange awakened the unborn Aaliyah in the Lady Jessica's womb. Have you considered what it meant for Aaliyah to be born into this universe fully cognitive, possessed of all her mother's memories and knowledge? No rape could be more terrifying. Without the sacred melange, Muad'Dib would not have become leader of all Fremen. Without her holy experience, Aaliyah would not be Aaliyah. Without your blind Fremen cruelty, you would not be a priest. I know you, Fremen. You think Muad'Dib is yours because he mated with Chaney, because he adopted Fremen customs. But he was an Atreides first, and he was trained by a Bene Gesserit adept. He possessed disciplines totally unknown to you. You thought he brought you new organization and a new mission. He promised to transform your desert planet into a water-rich paradise. And while he dazzled you with such visions, he took your virginity. Such heresy does not change the fact that the ecological transformation of Dune proceeds apace. And I committed the heresy of tracing the roots of that transformation, of exploring the consequences. That battle out there on the plains of Arrakeen may have taught the universe that Fremen could defeat Imperial Sardaukar, but what else did it teach? When the stellar empire of the Carino family became a Fremen empire under Muad'Dib, what else did the empire become? Your jihad only took 12 years, but what a lesson it taught. Now, the Empire understands the sham of Muad'Dib's marriage to the Princess Irulan. You dare accuse Muad'Dib of sham? Though you kill me for it, it's not heresy. The princess became his consort, not his mate. Chaney. His little Fremen darling. She's his mate. Everyone knows this. Irulan was the key to a throne, nothing more. It's easy to see why those who conspire against Muad'Dib use your analysis of history as their rallying argument. I'll not persuade you, I know that. But the argument of the conspiracy came before my analysis. 12 years of Muad'Dib's jihad created the argument. That's what united the ancient power groups and ignited the conspiracy against Muad'Dib.
Such a rich store of myths enfolds Paul Muad'Dib, the Bentat Emperor, and his sister Aaliyah, it is difficult to see the real persons behind these veils. But there were, after all, a man born Paul Atreides and a woman born Aaliyah. Their flesh was subject to space and time, and even though their oracular powers placed them beyond the usual limits of time and space, they came from human stock. They experienced real events which left real traces upon a real universe. To understand them, it must be seen that their catastrophe was the catastrophe of all mankind. This work is dedicated then not to Muad'Dib or his sister, but to their heirs. To all of us. Dedication in the Muad'Dib Concordance as copied from the Tabla Memoriam of the Mahdi Spirit Cult. Muad'Dib's imperial reign generated more historians than any other era in human history. Most of them argued a particular viewpoint, jealous and sectarian, but it says something about the peculiar impact of this man that he aroused such passions on so many diverse worlds. Of course, he contained the ingredients of history, ideal and idealized. This man, born Paul Atreides in an ancient great family, received the deep Pranabindu training from the Lady Jessica, his Bene Gesserit mother, and had, through this, a superb control over muscles and nerves. But more than that, he was a mentat, an intellect whose capacities surpassed those of the religiously proscribed mechanical computers used by the ancients. Above all else, Muad'Dib was the Kwisatz Haderach, which the sisterhood's breeding program had sought across thousands of generations. The Kwisatz Haderach, then, the one who could be many places at once, this prophet, this man through whom the Bene Gesserit hoped to control human destiny, this man became Emperor Muad'Dib and executed a marriage of convenience with a daughter of the Padishah Emperor he had defeated. Think on the paradox, the failure implicit in this moment, for you surely have read other histories and know the surface facts. Muad'Dib's wild Fremen did indeed overwhelm the Padishah Shaddam IV. They toppled the Sadukar legions, the allied forces of the great houses, the Harkonnen armies, and the mercenaries bought with money voted in the Landsraad. He brought the Spacing Guild to its knees and placed his own sister Alia on the religious throne the Bene Gesserit had thought their own. He did all these things, and more. Muad'Dib's Kizerat missionaries carried their religious war across space in a jihad whose major impetus endured only 12 standard years, but in that time, religious colonialism brought all but a fraction of the human universe under one rule. He did this because capture of Arrakis, that planet known more often as Dune, gave him a monopoly over the ultimate coin of the realm, the geriatric spice mélange, the poison that gave life. Here was another ingredient of ideal history, a material whose psychic chemistry unravelled time. Without Mélange, the sisterhood's reverend mothers could not perform their feats of observation and human control. Without Mélange, the guild's steersmen could not navigate across space. Without Mélange, billions upon billions of imperial citizens would die of addictive withdrawal. Without Mélange, Paul Muad'Dib could not prophesy. We know this moment of supreme power contained failure. There can be only one answer, that completely accurate and total prediction is lethal. Other histories say Muad'Dib was defeated by obvious plotters, the guild, the sisterhood, and the scientific amoralists of the Bene Tlelax with their face dancer disguises. Other histories point out the spies in Muad'Dib's household. They make much of the Dune Tarot, which clouded Muad'Dib's powers of prophecy. Some show how Muad'Dib was made to accept the services of a Gola, the flesh brought back from the dead and trained to destroy him. But certainly they must know this Gola was Duncan Idaho, the Atreides lieutenant who perished, saving the life of the young Paul. Yet they delineate the Kizerat Cabal, guided by Korba the panegyrist. They take us step by step through Korba's plan to make a martyr of Muad'Dib and place the blame on Cheney, the Fremen concubine. How can any of this explain the facts as history has revealed them? They cannot. Only through the lethal nature of prophecy can we understand the failure of such enormous and far-seeing power. Hopefully, other historians will learn something from this revelation. Analysis of History, Muad'Dib, by Bronso of Aix. There exists no separation between gods and men. One blends softly casual into the other. Proverbs of Muad'Dib. Despite the murderous nature of the plot he hoped to devise, the thoughts of Sightail, the Tlelaxu face dancer, returned again and again to rueful compassion. "I shall regret causing death and misery to Muad'Dib," he told himself. He kept this benignity carefully hidden from his fellow conspirators. Such feelings told him, though, that he found it easier to identify with the victim than with the attackers, a thing characteristic of the Tlelaxu. Sightail stood in bemused silence, somewhat apart from the others. The argument about psychic poison had been going on for some time now. It was energetic and vehement, but polite in that blindly compulsive way adepts of the great schools always adopted for matters close to their dogma.
"When you think you have him skewered, right then you'll find him unwounded."
That was the old reverend mother of the Bene Gesserit, Gaius Helen Mohiam, their hostess here on Wallach 9. She was a black-robed stick figure, a witch crone seated in a floater chair at Sightail's left. Her Abba hood had been thrown back to expose a leathery face beneath silver hair. Deeply pocketed eyes stared out of skull-mask features. They were using a Mirabassa language, honed phalange consonants and joined vowels. It was an instrument for conveying fine emotional subtleties. "Edric," the guild steersman replied to the Reverend Mother now with a vocal curtsy contained in a sneer, a lovely touch of disdainful politeness. Sightail looked at the guild envoy. Edric swam in a container of orange gas, only a few paces away. His container sat in the centre of the transparent dome which the Bene Gesserit had built for this meeting. The guildsman was an elongated figure, vaguely humanoid, with finned feet and hugely fanned membranous hands, a fish in a strange sea. His tank's vents emitted a pale orange cloud, rich with the smell of the geriatric spice melange.
"If we go on this way, we'll die of stupidity."
That was the fourth person present, the potential member of the conspiracy. Princess Irulan, wife, but not mate, Sightail reminded himself, of their mutual foe. She stood at a corner of Edric's tank, a tall, blonde beauty, splendid in a robe of blue whale fur and matching hat. Gold buttons glittered at her ears. She carried herself with an aristocrat's hauteur, but something in the absorbed smoothness of her features betrayed the controls of her Bene Gesserit background. Sightail's mind turned from nuances of language and faces to nuances of location. All around the dome lay hills, mangy with melting snow, which reflected mottled wet blueness from the small blue-white sun hanging at the meridian.
Why this particular place? Sightail wondered.
The Bene Gesserit seldom did anything casually. Take the dome's open plan. A more conventional and confining space might have inflicted the guildsman with claustrophobic nervousness. Inhibitions in his psyche were those of birth and life off-planet in open space. To have built this place, especially for Edric, though, what a sharp finger that pointed at his weakness. What here, Sightail wondered, was aimed at me?
"Have you nothing to say for yourself, Sightail?"
the Reverend Mother demanded.
"You wish to draw me into this fool's fight?" Sightail asked. "Very well. We're dealing with a potential messiah. You don't launch a frontal attack upon such a one. Martyrdom would defeat us."
They all stared at him.
"You think that's the only danger?"
the Reverend Mother demanded, voice wheezing. Sightail shrugged. He had chosen a bland, round-faced appearance for this meeting. Jolly features and vapid full lips, the body of a bloated dumpling. It occurred to him, now as he studied his fellow conspirators, that he had made an ideal choice, out of instinct, perhaps. He alone in this group could manipulate fleshly appearance across a wide spectrum of bodily shapes and features. He was the human chameleon, a face dancer, and the shape he wore now invited others to judge him too lightly.
"Well,"
the Reverend Mother pressed.
"I was enjoying the silence," Sightail said. "Our hostilities are better left unvoiced."
The Reverend Mother drew back, and Sightail saw her reassessing him. They were all products of profound pranabindu training, capable of muscle and nerve control that few humans ever achieved. But Sightail, a face dancer, had muscles and nerve linkages the others didn't even possess, plus a special quality of simpatico, a mimic's insight with which he could put on the psyche of another as well as the other's appearance. Sightail gave her enough time to complete the reassessment, said,
"Poison."
He uttered the word with the atonals, which said he alone understood its secret meaning. The guildsman stirred, and his voice rolled from the glittering speaker globe which orbited a corner of his tank above Irulan.
"We're discussing psychic poison, not a physical one."
Sightail laughed. Mirabassa laughter could flay an opponent, but he held nothing back now. Irulan smiled in appreciation, but the corners of the Reverend Mother's eyes revealed a faint hint of anger.
"Stop that!"
Mohayam rasped. Sightail stopped, but he had their attention now. Edric in silent rage, the Reverend Mother alert in her anger, Irulan amused but puzzled.
"Our friend Edric suggests," Sightail said, "that a pair of Bene Gesserit witches, trained in all their subtle ways, have not learned the true uses of deception."
Mohayam turned to stare out at the cold hills of her Bene Gesserit homeworld. She was beginning to see the vital thing here, Sightail realized. That was good. Irulan, though, was another matter.
"Are you one of us or not, Sightail?"
Edric asked. He stared out of tiny, rodent eyes.
"My allegiance is not the issue," Sightail said.
He kept his attention on Irulan.
"You are wondering, Princess, if this was why you came all those parsecs. Risked so much?"
She nodded agreement.
"Was it to bandy platitudes with a humanoid fish or dispute with a fat Tlilaxu face dancer?" Sightail asked.
She stepped away from Edric's tank, shaking her head in annoyance at the thick odour of melange. Edric took this moment to pop a melange pill into his mouth. He ate the spice and breathed it, and, no doubt, drank it, Sightail noted. Understandable, because the spice heightened a steersman's prescience, gave him the power to guide a guild highliner across space at translight speeds. With spice awareness, he found that line of the ship's future which avoided peril. Edric smelled another kind of peril now, but his crutch of prescience might not find it.
"I think it was a mistake for me to come here," Irulan said.
The Reverend Mother turned, opened her eyes, closed them, a curiously reptilian gesture. Sightail shifted his gaze from Irulan to the tank, inviting the princess to share his viewpoint. She would, Sightail knew, see Edric as a repellent figure, the bold stare, these monstrous feet and hands moving softly in the gas, the smoky swirling of orange eddies around him. She would wonder about his sex habits, thinking how odd it would be to mate with such a one. Even the field force generator which recreated for Edric the weightlessness of space would set him apart from her now.
"Princess," Sightail said, "because of Edric here, your husband's oracular sight cannot stumble upon certain incidents, including this one, presumably."
"Presumably," Irulan said.
Eyes closed, the Reverend Mother nodded.
"The phenomenon of prescience is poorly understood even by its initiates," she said.
"I am a full guild navigator and have the power," Edric said.
Again the Reverend Mother opened her eyes. This time she stared at the face dancer, eyes probing with that peculiar Bene Gesserit intensity. She was weighing minutiae. "No, Reverend Mother," Sightail murmured, "I am not as simple as I appeared."
"We don't understand this power of second sight," Irulan said. "There's a point. Edric says my husband cannot see, know, or predict what happens within the sphere of a navigator's influence, but how far does that influence extend?"
"There are people and things in our universe which I know only by their effects," Edric said, his fish mouth held in a thin line. "I know they have been here, there, somewhere. As water creatures stir up the currents in their passage, so the prescient stir up time. I have seen where your husband has been. Never have I seen him, nor the people who truly share his aims and loyalties. This is the concealment which an adept gives to those who are his."
"Irulan is not yours," Sightail said, and he looked sideways at the princess.
"We all know why the conspiracy must be conducted only in my presence," Edric said.
Using the voice mode for describing a machine, Irulan said,
"You have your uses, apparently."
"She sees him now for what he is," Sightail thought. "Good." "The future is a thing to be shaped," Sightail said. "Hold that thought, princess." Irulan glanced at the face dancer.
"People who share Paul's aims and loyalties," she said. "Certain of his Fremen legionaries, then, wear his cloak. I have seen him prophesy for them, heard their cries of adulation for their Mahdi, their Muad'Dib."
It has occurred to her, Sightail thought, that she is on trial here, that a judgment remains to be made which could preserve her or destroy her. She sees the trap we set for her. Momentarily, Sightail's gaze locked with that of the Reverend Mother, and he experienced the odd realization that they had shared this thought about Irulan. The Bene Gesserit, of course, had briefed their princess, primed her with the lie adroit. But the moment always came when a Bene Gesserit must trust her own training and instincts.
"Princess, I know what it is you most desire from the Emperor," Edric said.
"Who does not know it?" Irulan asked.
"You wish to be the founding mother of the royal dynasty," Edric said, as though he had not heard her. "Unless you join us, that will never happen. Take my oracular word on it. The Emperor married you for political reasons, but you'll never share his bed."
"So the Oracle is also a voyeur," Irulan sneered.
"The Emperor is more firmly wedded to his Fremen concubine than he is to you," Edric snapped.
"And she gives him no heir," Irulan said.
"Reason is the first victim of strong emotion," Sightail murmured. He sensed the outpouring of Irulan's anger, saw his admonition take effect.
"She gives him no heir," Irulan said, her voice measuring out controlled calmness, "because I am secretly administering a contraceptive. Is that the sort of admission you wanted from me?"
"It'd not be a thing for the Emperor to discover,"
Edric said, smiling.
"I have lies ready for him," Irulan said. "He may have truth sense, but some lies are easier to believe than the truth."
"You must make the choice, princess," Sightail said. "But understand what it is protects you."
"Paul is fair with me," she said. "I sit in his council."
"In the 12 years you've been his princess consort," Edric asked, "has he shown you the slightest warmth?" Irulan shook her head. "He deposed your father with his infamous Fremen horde, married you to fix his claim to the throne, yet he has never crowned you empress,"
Edric said. "Edric tries to sway you with emotion, princess," Sightail said. "Is that not interesting?" She glanced at the face dancer, saw the bold smile on his features, answered it with raised eyebrows. She was fully aware now, Sightail saw, that if she left this conference under Edric's sway, part of their plot, these moments might be concealed from Paul's oracular vision. If she withheld commitment, though.
"Does it seem to you, Princess," Sightail asked, "that Edric holds undue sway in our conspiracy?"
"I've already agreed," Edric said, "that I'll defer to the best judgment offered in our councils."
"And who chooses the best judgment?" Sightail asked.
"Do you wish the princess to leave here without joining us?" Edric asked.
"He wishes her commitment to be a real one," the Reverend Mother growled. "There should be no trickery between us."
Irulan, Sightail saw, had relaxed into a thinking posture, hands concealed in the sleeves of her robe. She would be thinking now of the bait Edric had offered, to found a royal dynasty. She would be wondering what scheme the conspirators had provided to protect themselves from her. She would be weighing many things.
"Sightail," Irulan said presently, "it is said that you, Tleilaxu, have an odd system of honour. Your victims must always have a means of escape."
"If they can but find it," Sightail agreed.
"Am I a victim?" Irulan asked.
A burst of laughter escaped Sightail. The Reverend Mother snorted.
"Princess," Edric said, his voice softly persuasive, "you already are one of us. Have no fear of that. Do you not spy upon the Imperial household for your Bene Gesserit superiors?"
"Paul knows I report to my teachers," she said.
"But don't you give them the material for strong propaganda against your emperor?" Edric asked.
"Not our emperor," Sightail noted. "Your emperor.
Irulan is too much the Bene Gesserit to miss that slip." "The question is one of powers and how they may be used," Sightail said, moving closer to the guildsman's tank. "We of the Tleilaxu believe that in all the universe there is only the insatiable appetite of matter, that energy is the only true solid, and energy learns. Hear me well, Princess. Energy learns. This we call power."
"You haven't convinced me we can defeat the Emperor," Irulan said.
"We haven't even convinced ourselves," Sightail said.
"Everywhere we turn," Irulan said, "his power confronts us. He's the Kwisatz Haderach, the one who can be many places at once. He's the Mahdi whose merest whim is absolute command to his Kizarat missionaries. He's the Mentat whose computational mind surpasses the greatest ancient computers. He is Muad'Dib whose orders to the Fremen legions depopulate planets. He possesses oracular vision which sees into the future. He has that gene pattern which we Bene Gesserits covet for—"
"We know his attributes," the Reverend Mother interrupted. "And we know the abomination. His sister Alia possesses this gene pattern, but they're also humans, both of them. Thus they have weaknesses."
"And where are those human weaknesses?" the face dancer asked. "Shall we search for them in the religious arm of his jihad? Can the Emperor's Kizara be turned against him? What about the civil authority of the great houses? Can the Landsrat Congress do more than raise a verbal clamour?"
"I suggest the Combine Onet Ober Advancer Mercantil," Edric said, turning in his tank. "Chome is business, and business follows profits."
"Or perhaps the Emperor's mother," Sightail said.
"The Lady Jessica, I understand, remains on Caladan, but is in frequent communication with her son."
"That traitorous bitch," Moham said, voice level, "would I might disown my own hands which trained her."
"Our conspiracy requires a lever," Sightail said.
"We are more than conspirators," the Reverend Mother countered.
"Ah, yes," Sightail agreed. "We are energetic and we learn quickly.
This makes us the one true hope, the certain salvation of humankind. He spoke in the speech mode for absolute conviction, which was perhaps the ultimate sneer, coming as it did from a Tlelaxu. Only the Reverend Mother appeared to understand the subtlety. "Why?" she asked, directing the question at Sightail. Before the face dancer could answer, Edric cleared his throat, said,
"Let us not bandy philosophical nonsense. Every question can be boiled down to the one, why is there anything? Every religious, business, and governmental question has the single derivative, who will exercise the power? Alliances, combines, complexes, they all chase mirages unless they go for the power. All else is nonsense, as most thinking beings come to realize."
Sightail shrugged, a gesture designed solely for the Reverend Mother. Edric had answered her question for him. The pontificating fool was their major weakness. To make sure the Reverend Mother understood, Sightail said,
"Listening carefully to the teacher, one acquires an education."
The Reverend Mother nodded slowly.
"Princess," Edric said, "make your choice. You have been chosen as an instrument of destiny, the very finest."
"Save your praise for those who can be swayed by it," Irulan said. "Earlier you mentioned a ghost, a revenant with which we may contaminate the Emperor. Explain this."
"The Atreides will defeat himself," Edric crowed.
"Stop talking riddles," Irulan snapped. "What is this ghost?"
"A very unusual ghost," Edric said. "It has a body and a name. The body, that's the flesh of a renowned swordmaster known as Duncan Idaho. The name..."
"Idaho's dead," Irulan said. "Paul has mourned the loss often in my presence. He saw Idaho killed by my father Saduka."
"Even in defeat," Edric said, "your father's Saduka did not abandon wisdom. Let us suppose a wise Saduka commander recognized the swordmaster in a corpse his men had slain. What then? There exist uses for such flesh and training, if one acts swiftly."
"Atlelaxu Gola," Irulan whispered, looking sideways at Sightail.
Sightail, observing her attention, exercised his face dancer powers, shape flowing into shape, flesh moving and readjusting. Presently, a slender man stood before her. The face remained somewhat round, but darker and with slightly flattened features. High cheekbones formed shelves for eyes with definite epicanthic folds. The hair was black and unruly.
"A Gola of this appearance," Edric said, pointing to Sightail.
"Or merely another face dancer?"
Irulan asked.
"No face dancer," Edric said. "A face dancer risks exposure under prolonged surveillance. No, let us assume that our wise Saduka commander had Idaho's corpse preserved for the axolotl tanks. Why not? This corpse held the flesh and nerves of one of the finest swordsmen in history, an advisor to the Atreides, a military genius. What a waste to lose all that training and ability when it might be revived as an instructor for the Saduka."
"I heard not a whisper of this, and I was one of my father's confidants," Irulan said.
"Ah, but your father was a defeated man, and within a few hours you had been sold to the new emperor,"
Edric said.
"Was it done?" she demanded.
With a maddening air of complacency, Edric said,
"Let us presume that our wise Saduka commander, knowing the need for speed, immediately sent the preserved flesh of Idaho to the Bene Tlelaxu. Let us suppose further that the commander and his men died before conveying this information to your father, who couldn't have made much use of it anyway. There would remain then a physical fact, a bit of flesh which had been sent off to the Tlelaxu. There was only one way for it to be sent, of course, on a highliner. We of the Guild naturally know every cargo we transport. Learning of this one, would we not think it additional wisdom to purchase the Gola as a gift befitting an emperor?
You've done it, then, Irulan said.
Sightail, who had resumed his roly-poly first appearance, said, As our long-winded friend indicates, we've done it.
How has Idaho been conditioned? Irulan asked.
Idaho? Edric asked, looking at the Tlelaxu. Do you know of an Idaho Sightail?
We sold you a creature called Hate, Sightail said.
Ah, yes, Hate, Edric said. Why did you sell him to us?
Because we once bred a Kwisatz Haderach of our own, Sightail said. With a quick movement of her old head, the Reverend Mother looked up at him. You didn't tell us that, she accused.
You didn't ask, Sightail said.
How did you overcome your Kwisatz Haderach?
Irulan asked. A creature who has spent his life creating one particular representation of his selfdom will die rather than become the antithesis of that representation, Sightail said.
I do not understand,
Edric ventured.
He killed himself, the Reverend Mother growled.
Follow me well, Reverend Mother, Sightail warned, using a voice mode which said, You are not a sex object, have never been a sex object, cannot be a sex object. The Tlelaxu waited for the blatant emphasis to sink in. She must not mistake his intent. Realization must pass through anger into awareness that the Tlelaxu certainly could not make such an accusation, knowing as he must the breeding requirements of the sisterhood. His words, though, contained a gutter insult completely out of character for a Tlelaxu. Swiftly, using the Mirabasa placative mode, Edric tried to smooth over the moment.
Sightail, you told us you sold Hate because you shared our desire on how to use him.
Edric, you will remain silent until I give you permission to speak, Sightail said. And as the guildsman started to protest, the Reverend Mother snapped, Shut up, Edric! The guildsman drew back into his tank in flailing agitation.
Our own transient emotions aren't pertinent to a solution of the mutual problem, Sightail said. They cloud reasoning because the only relevant emotion is the basic fear which brought us to this meeting.
We understand, Irulan said, glancing at the Reverend Mother.
You must see the dangerous limitations of our shield, Sightail said. The oracle cannot chance upon what it cannot understand.
You are devious, Sightail, Irulan said.
How devious she must not guess, Sightail thought. When this is done, we will possess a Kwisatz Haderach we can control. These others will possess nothing.
What was the origin of your Kwisatz Haderach?
The Reverend Mother asked.
We've dabbled in various pure essences, Sightail said. Pure good and pure evil. A pure villain who delights only in creating pain and terror can be quite educational.
The old Baron Harkonnen, our Emperor's grandfather, was he a Tlelaxu creation?
Irulan asked.
Not one of ours, Sightail said. But then nature often produces creations as deadly as ours. We merely produce them under conditions where we can study them.
I will not be passed by and treated this way, Edric protested. Who is it hides this meeting from?
You see, Sightail asked. Whose best judgment conceals us? What judgment?
I wish to discuss our mode of giving Hate to the Emperor, Edric insisted. It's my understanding that Hate reflects the old morality that the Atreides learned on his birth world. Hate is supposed to make it easy for the Emperor to enlarge his moral nature, to delineate the positive-negative elements of life and religion.
Sightail smiled, passing a benign gaze over his companions. They were as he'd been led to expect. The old Reverend Mother wielded her emotions like a scythe. Irulan had been well trained for a task at which she had failed, a flawed Bene Gesserit creation. Edric was no more, and no less, than the magician's hand. He might conceal and distract. For now, Edric relapsed into sullen silence as the others ignored him.
"Do I understand that this hate is intended to poison Paul's psyche?"
Irulan asked. "More or less," Sytel said.
"And what of the Kizarat?"
Irulan asked. "It requires only the slightest shift in emphasis, a glissade of the emotions to transform envy into enmity," Sytel said.
"And Chom?" Irulan asked.
"They will rally round Prophet," Sytel said.
"What of the other power groups?"
"One invokes the name of government," Sytel said. "We will annex the less powerful in the name of morality and progress. Our opposition will die of its own entanglements."
"Alia too?"
"Hate is a multi-purpose scholar," Sytel said. "The Emperor's sister is of an age when she can be distracted by a charming male designed for that purpose. She will be attracted by his maleness and by his abilities as a mentat." Mohayam allowed her old eyes to go wide in surprise.
"The Golas a mentat? That's a dangerous move."
"To be accurate," Irulan said, "a mentat must have accurate data. What if Paul asks him to define the purpose behind our gift?"
"Hate will tell the truth," Sytel said. "It makes no difference."
"So you leave an escape door open for Paul," Irulan said.
"Amentat," Mohayam muttered.
Sytel glanced at the old Reverend Mother, seeing the ancient hates which coloured her responses. From the days of the Butlerian Jihad, when thinking machines had been wiped from most of the universe, computers had inspired distrust. Old emotions coloured the human computer as well.
"I do not like the way you smile," Mohayam said abruptly, speaking in the truth mode as she glared up at Sytel.
In the same mode, Sytel said, "And I think less of what pleases you, but we must work together. We all see that."
He glanced at the guildsman.
"Don't we, Edric?"
"You teach painful lessons," Edric said. "I presume you wished to make it plain that I must not assert myself against the combined judgments of my fellow conspirators."
"You see, he can be taught," Sytel said.
"I see other things as well," Edric growled. "The Atreides holds a monopoly on the spice. Without it I cannot probe the future. The Bene Gesserit lose their truth sense. We have stockpiles, but these are finite. Mélange is a powerful coin."
"Our civilization has more than one coin," Sytel said. "Thus, the law of supply and demand fails."
"You think to steal the secret of it?" Mohayam wheezed. "And him with a planet guarded by his mad Fremen?"
"The Fremen are civil, educated, and ignorant," Sytel said. "They are not mad. They are trained to believe, not to know. Belief can be manipulated. Only knowledge is dangerous."
"But will I be left with something to father a royal dynasty?" Irulan asked.
They all heard the commitment in her voice, but only Edric smiled at it.
"Something," Sytel said. "Something."
"It means the end of this Atreides as a ruling force," Edric said.
"I should imagine that others less gifted as oracles have made that prediction," Sytel said. "For them, Mektub al-Mela, as the Fremen say."
"The thing was written with salt," Irulan translated.
As she spoke, Sytel recognized what the Bene Gesserit had arrayed here for him. A beautiful and intelligent female who could never be his.
"Ah, well," he thought, "perhaps I'll copy her for another."
Every civilization must contend with an unconscious force which can block, betray, or countermand almost any conscious intention of the collectivity. Tleloxu theorem, unproven. Paul sat on the edge of his bed and began stripping off his desert boots. They smelled rancid from the lubricant which eased the action of the heel-powered pumps that drove his stillsuit. It was late. He had prolonged his nighttime walk and caused worry for those who loved him. Admittedly, the walks were dangerous, but it was a kind of danger he could recognize and meet immediately. Something compelling and attractive surrounded walking anonymously at night in the streets of Erekin. He tossed the boots into the corner beneath the room's lone glow globe, attacked the seal strips of his stillsuit. Gods below, how tired he was! The tiredness stopped at his muscles, though, and left his mind seething. Watching the mundane activities of everyday life filled him with profound envy. Most of that nameless flowing life outside the walls of his keep couldn't be shared by an emperor. But to walk down a public street without attracting attention, what a privilege! To pass by the clamouring of mendicant pilgrims, to hear a Fremen curse a shopkeeper. You have damp hands! Paul smiled at the memory, slipped out of his stillsuit. He stood, naked and oddly attuned to his world. Dune was a world of paradox now, a world under siege, yet the centre of power. To come under siege, he decided, was the inevitable fate of power. He stared down at the green carpeting, feeling its rough texture against his soles. The streets had been ankle-deep in sand blown over the shield wall on the stratus wind. Foot traffic had churned it into choking dust, which clogged stillsuit filters. He could smell the dust even now, despite a blower cleaning at the portals of his keep. It was an odour full of desert memories, other days, other dangers. Compared to those other days, the peril in his lonely walks remained minor. But putting on a still suit, he put on the desert. The suit, with all its apparatus for reclaiming his body's moisture, guided his thoughts in subtle ways, fixed his movements in a desert pattern. He became wild Fremen. More than a disguise, the suit made of him a stranger to his city self. In the stillsuit, he abandoned security and put on the old skills of violence. Pilgrims and townfolk passed him then with eyes downcast. They left the wild ones strictly alone out of prudence. If the desert had a face for city folk, it was a Fremen face concealed by a stillsuit's mouth-nose filters. In truth, there existed now only the small danger that someone from the old Siege days might mark him by his walk, by his odour, or by his eyes. Even then, the chances of meeting an enemy remained small. A swish of door hangings and a wash of light broke his reverie. Chaney entered, bearing his coffee service on a platinum tray. Two slaved glow globes followed her, darting to their positions, one at the head of their bed, one hovering beside her to light her work. Chaney moved with an ageless air of fragile power, so self-contained, so vulnerable. Something about the way she bent over the coffee service reminded him then of their first days. Her features remained darkly elfin, seemingly unmarked by the years, unless one examined the outer corners of her whiteless eyes, noting the lines there. Sand tracks, the Fremen of the desert called them. Steam wafted from the pot as she lifted the lid by its Hagar emerald knob. He could tell the coffee wasn't yet ready by the way she replaced the lid. The pot, fluting silver female shape, pregnant, had come to him as a ganema, a spoil of battle won when he'd slain the former owner in single combat. Jamis, that had been the man's name. Jamis. What an odd immortality death had earned for Jamis. Knowing death to be inevitable, had Jamis carried that particular one in his hand? Chaney put out cups, blue pottery, squatting like attendants beneath the immense pot. There were three cups, one for each drinker and one for all the former owners. "It'll only be a moment," she said. She looked at him then, and Paul wondered how he appeared in her eyes. Was he yet the exotic off-worlder? Slim and wiry but water fat when compared to Fremen. Had he remained the Usul of his tribal name who'd taken her in Fremen Tau while there'd been fugitives in the desert? Paul stared down at his own body. Hard muscles, slender. A few more scars, but essentially the same despite 12 years as Emperor. Looking up, he glimpsed his face in a shelf mirror. Blue, blue Fremen eyes, mark of spice addiction. A sharp Atreides nose. He looked the proper grandson for an Atreides who died in the bull ring, creating a spectacle for his people. Something the old man had said slipped then into Paul's mind. One who rules assumes irrevocable responsibility for the ruled. You are a husbandman. This demands at times a selfless act of love, which may only be amusing to those you rule. People still remembered that old man with affection. And what have I done for the Atreides' name? Paul asked himself. I've loosed the wolf among the sheep. For a moment, he contemplated all the death and violence going on in his name. Into bed now, Cheney said, in a sharp tone of command that Paul knew would have shocked his imperial subjects. He obeyed, laid back with his hands behind his head, letting himself be lulled by the pleasant familiarity of Cheney's movements. The room around them struck him suddenly with amusement. It was not at all what the populace must imagine as the Emperor's bedchamber. The yellow light of restless glow globes moved the shadows in an array of coloured glass jars on a shelf behind Cheney. Paul named their contents silently. The dry ingredients of the desert pharmacopoeia. Unguents, incense, mementos. A pinch of sand from Siach Tabur. A lock of hair from their firstborn, long dead. 12 years dead. An innocent bystander killed in the battle that had made Paul emperor. The rich odour of spiced coffee filled the room. Paul inhaled, his glance falling on a yellow bowl beside the tray where Cheney was preparing the coffee. The bowl held ground nuts. The inevitable poison snooper mounted beneath the table waved its insect arms over the food. The snooper angered him. They'd never needed snoopers in the desert days. Coffee's ready, Cheney said. Are you hungry? His angry denial was drowned in the whistling scream of a spice lighter hurling itself spaceward from the field outside Arakeen. Cheney saw his anger, though, poured their coffee, put a cup near his hand. She sat down on the foot of the bed, exposed his legs, began rubbing them where the muscles were knotted from walking in the stillsuit. Softly, with a casual air which did not deceive him, she said, Let us discuss Irulan's desire for a child. Paul's eyes snapped wide open. He studied Cheney carefully. Irulan's been back from Warlach less than 2 days, he said. Has she been at you already? We've not discussed her frustrations, Cheney said. Paul forced his mind to mental alertness, examined Cheney in the harsh light of observational minutiae, the Bene Gesserit way his mother had taught him in violation of her vows. It was a thing he didn't like doing with Cheney. Part of her hold on him lay in the fact he so seldom needed his tension-building powers with her. Cheney mostly avoided indiscreet questions. She maintained a Fremen sense of good manners. Hers were more often practical questions. What interested Cheney were facts which bore on the position of her man, his strength in council, the loyalty of his legions, the abilities and talents of his allies. Her memory held catalogues of names and cross-indexed details. She could rattle off the major weakness of every known enemy, the potential dispositions of opposing forces, battle plans of their military leaders, the tooling and production capacities of basic industries. Why now, Paul wondered, did she ask about Irulan? I've troubled your mind, Cheney said. That wasn't my intention. What was your intention? She smiled. Shyly, meeting his gaze. If you're angered, love, please don't hide it. Paul sank back against the headboard. Shall I put her away? He asked. Her use is limited now, and I don't like the things I sense about her trip home to the Sisterhood. You'll not put her away, Cheney said. She went on massaging his legs, spoke matter-of-factly. You've said many times she's your contact with our enemies, that you can read their plans through her actions. Then why ask about her desire for a child? I think it'd disconcert her enemies and put Irulan in a vulnerable position should you make her pregnant. He read by the movements of her hands on his legs what that statement had cost her. A lump rose in his throat. Softly, he said, Cheney, beloved, I swore an oath never to take her into my bed. A child would give her too much power. Would you have her displace you? I have no place. Not so, Sihaya, my desert springtime. What is this sudden concern for Irulan? It's concern for you, not for her. If she carried an Atreides child, her friends would question her loyalties. The less trust our enemies place in her, the less use she is to them. A child for her could mean your death, Paul said. You know the plotting in this place. A movement of his arm encompassed the keep. You must have an heir, she husked. Ah, he said. So that was it. Chaney had not produced a child for him. Someone else, then, must do it. Why not Irulan? That was the way Chaney's mind worked. And it must be done in an act of love, because all the Empire avowed strong taboos against artificial ways. Chaney had come to a Fremen decision. Paul studied her face in this new light. It was a face he knew better in some ways than his own. He had seen this face, soft with passion, in the sweetness of sleep, awash in fears and angers and griefs. He closed his eyes, and Chaney came into his memories as a girl once more, veiled in springtime, singing, waking from sleep beside him. So perfect that the very vision of her consumed him. In his memory, she smiled, shyly at first, then strained against the vision as though she longed to escape. Paul's mouth went dry. For a moment, his nostrils tasted the smoke of a devastated future and the voice of another kind of vision commanding him to disengage, disengage, disengage. His prophetic visions had been eavesdropping on eternity for such a long while, catching snatches of foreign tongues, listening to stones and to flesh not his own. Since the day of his first encounter with terrible purpose, he had peered at the future, hoping to find peace. There existed a way, of course. He knew it by heart without knowing the heart of it. A rote future, strict in its instructions to him. Disengage, disengage, disengage. Paul opened his eyes, looked at the decision in Chaney's face. She had stopped massaging his legs, sat still now. Purest Fremen. Her features remained familiar beneath the blue Najoni scarf she often wore about her hair in the privacy of their chambers. But the mask of decision sat on her, an ancient and alien to him way of thinking. Fremen women had shared their men for thousands of years, not always in peace, but with a way of making the fat non-destructive. Something mysteriously Fremen in this fashion had happened in Chaney. You'll give me the only heir I want, he said. You've seen this? She asked, making it obvious by her emphasis that she referred to prescience. As he had done many times, Paul wondered how he could explain the delicacy of the oracle, the timelines without number which vision waved before him on an undulating fabric. He sighed, remembered water lifted from a river in the hollow of his hands, trembling, draining. Memory drenched his face in it. How could he drench himself in futures growing increasingly obscure from the pressures of too many oracles? You've not seen it, then, Chaney said. That vision future, scarce any longer accessible to him except at the expenditure of life-draining effort. What could it show them except grief? Paul asked himself. He felt that he occupied an inhospitable middle zone, a wasted place where his emotions drifted, swayed, swept outward in unchecked restlessness. Chaney covered his legs, said, An heir to House Atreides. This is not something you leave to chance or one woman. That was a thing his mother might have said, Paul thought. He wondered if the Lady Jessica had been in secret communication with Chaney. His mother would think in terms of House Atreides. It was a pattern bred and conditioned into her by the Bene Gesserit, and would hold true even now when her powers were turned against the sisterhood. You listened when Irulan came to me today, he accused. I listened. She spoke without looking at him. Paul focused his memory on the encounter with Irulan. He let himself into the family salon, noted an unfinished robe on Chaney's loom. There had been an acrid worm smell to the place, an evil odour which almost hid the underlying cinnamon bite of melange. Someone had spilled unchanged spice essence and left it to combine there with a spice-based rug. It had not been a felicitous combination. Spice essence had dissolved the rug. Oily marks lay congealed on the plastone floor where the rug had been. He'd thought to send for someone to clean away the mess, but Hera, Stilgar's wife and Chaney's closest feminine friend, had slipped in to announce Irulan. He'd been forced to conduct the interview in the presence of that evil smell, unable to escape a Fremen superstition that evil smells foretold disaster. Hera withdrew as Irulan entered. "Welcome," Paul said. Irulan wore a robe of grey whale fur. She pulled it close, touched a hand to her hair. He could see her wondering at his mild tone. The angry words she'd obviously prepared for this meeting could be sensed, leaving her mind in a welter of second thoughts. "You came to report that the Sisterhood had lost its last vestige of morality," he said. "Isn't it dangerous to be that ridiculous?" she asked. "To be ridiculous and dangerous, a questionable alliance," he said. His renegade Bene Gesserit training detected her putting down an impulse to withdraw. The effort exposed a brief glimpse of underlying fear, and he saw she'd been assigned a task not to her liking. "They expect a bit too much from a princess of the Blood Royal," he said. Irulan grew very still, and Paul became aware that she had locked herself into a vice-like control. A heavy burden indeed, he thought, and he wondered why prescient visions had given him no glimpse of this possible future. Slowly, Irulan relaxed. There was no point in surrendering to fear, no point in retreat, she had decided. "You've allowed the weather to fall into a very primitive pattern," she said, rubbing her arms through the robe. "It was dry, and there was a sandstorm today. Are you never going to let it rain here?" "You didn't come here to talk about the weather," Paul said. He felt that he had been submerged in double meanings. Was Irulan trying to tell him something which her training would not permit her to say openly? It seemed that way. He felt that he had been cast adrift suddenly and now must thrash his way back to some steady place. "I must have a child," she said. He shook his head from side to side. "I must have my way," she snapped. "If need be, I'll find another father for my child. I'll cuckold you and dare you to expose me." "Cuckold me all you wish," he said, "but no child.